We would like to send out a special thanks to the fun and challenging Best Fiends for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Download Best Fiends for free from the App Store or Google Play. Plus, earn even more with $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Enjoy the show! April 16th, 2003. Kendall County, Texas. 45-year-old Colonel Philip Hsu, who works as a staff psychiatrist for the United States Air Force, leaves his residence to drive to work. 2.5 hours later, Colonel Shu's car is seen driving erratically down the interstate before it crashes into some trees and Hsu is found dead in the driver's seat. Even though his death is ruled to be a suicide, there are a number of suspicious discrepancies, as there is duct tape around his wrists and feet, a large gash in his chest, and both of his nipples have been removed. There is suspicion that Hsu's ex-wife had him tortured and killed in order to cash in on some life insurance policies, but even though a judge eventually rules that Hsu was the victim of a homicide, his official cause of death has never changed. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be delving into one of the oddest mysteries we've ever covered, the unexplained 2003 death of Colonel Philip Hsu. This is a case which has haunted me ever since I saw it profiled in an episode of the true crime show 48 Hours, and I even featured it in one of the Halloween-themed articles I wrote for Crack.com several years ago. So needless to say, a Trail Went Cold episode about this story is long overdue. I've covered a lot of cases in which a victim's death was ruled to be a suicide, even though there were a number of suspicious details which made their loved ones suspect foul play. But the circumstances of this case are so bizarre that it stands out from the pack. Colonel Philip Hsu was a psychiatrist with the United States Air Force who was only months away from retirement and had made future plans with his wife Tracy, but after leaving his home one morning for what should have been a routine workday, he was killed in a car crash less than 3 hours later. But this was no ordinary car crash, because when Hsu's body was found, he had duct tape wrapped around his wrists and feet, and a number of unexplained injuries which could not have been caused by the accident, as there was a large gash in his chest, and both of his nipples and a digit from one of his fingers had been removed and could not be found at the scene. But believe it or not, the authorities were inclined to believe that Colonel Hsu inflicted these injuries on himself before intentionally crashing his car in a very elaborate suicide. Prior to his death, Hsu had displayed a lot of paranoid and erratic behavior because he was convinced his ex-wife was planning to kill him in order to cash in on some lucrative insurance policies she had on his life as part of their divorce settlement. For this reason, some people, including Hsu's widow, believed that his ex-wife had abducted and tortured him, and when he attempted to make an escape, he wound up losing control of his car and was killed in a fatal crash. At a civil trial years later, a judge publicly expressed his belief that Colonel Hsu was the victim of a homicide, but since he did not have the legal authority to make that ruling, the authorities still officially consider his death to be a suicide. It's a pretty baffling case, because even though there are a lot of odd discrepancies about the suicide ruling, which cannot be adequately explained, it's not that easy to come up with a scenario involving foul play which makes much sense either, so we're going to explore both sides on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the bizarre unexplained death of Colonel Philip Hsu. Our story begins in Kendall County, Texas in 2003, and our central figure is 54-year-old Philip Michael Shue. Philip, who goes by the name Phil, lives just outside the town of Burney with his wife Tracy Shue and holds the rank of colonel in the United States Air Force. Originally born in Brookville, Ohio, Phil joined the Air Force in 1970 and served as a navigator for 4 years, but had to cut his career short after he was diagnosed with Meniere's disease, a disorder which is caused by the buildup of fluid in the chambers of the inner ear. As a result, Phil had several episodes in which he experienced a sudden loss of consciousness, and of course, this made him too much of a liability to be an aviator. After leaving the Air Force for 10 years, Phil trained to become a physician's assistant and completed medical school before he was accepted into a 4-year residency program at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Medical Center in Dayton, Ohio. Upon completion of this program, he was assigned to Eglin Air Force Base in Florida and became their chief medical director of inpatient mental health. It was here where Phil first got acquainted with his future wife Tracy, who was assigned there as an Air Force nurse, and they gradually began a relationship. During this time period, Phil was legally separated from his first wife Nancy, whom he'd originally married back in 1970. The couple were high school sweethearts, but Phil would later say that there was no real love or compatibility in the relationship, and he only agreed to marry Nancy because she was 6 months pregnant at the time. She soon gave birth to a son named Jeffrey, though many people noticed that he did not appear to look all that much like Phil. At the time, Nancy had supposedly been carrying on an affair with another man, but Phil never asked for any paternity testing to confirm if he was Jeffrey's biological father and raised him as if he were his own son. Even though Phil and Nancy's marriage had completely fallen apart by the end of the 1980s, their divorce was not actually finalized until 1992, as Phil wanted to complete his service commitment and ensure that Nancy, who was unemployed at the time, would still be allowed to retain all of his military benefits. By this point, Phil was already deeply involved in his relationship with Tracy, and they would get married less than 1 year following the divorce. 10 years later, Phil and Tracy were living together in Kendall County, Texas, as he was assigned to work as a staff psychiatrist / aerospace medicine physician at the Wilford Hall Medical Center, located at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. The Shues had made plans for the future, as Phil was finally going to retire from the Air Force during the fall. He was accepted into a forensic psychiatry fellowship program at the University of Alabama, and the couple had already put a down payment on a new lakefront home near Birmingham. At around 5:45 a.m. on the morning of April the 16th, after saying goodbye to his wife, Phil left his home in his 1995 Mercury Tracer in order to drive to Lackland Air Force Base, which was located about 30 miles away. This was about an hour earlier than when Phil usually left for work, but he said he needed to catch up on some paperwork that morning. But over the course of the next 2.5 hours, a bizarre series of events would take place, which have never been adequately explained. Sometime between 8 and 8:15 a.m., a pair of motorists would report seeing Phil's Mercury Tracer erratically swerving while driving westbound down Interstate 10. This location was relatively close to San Antonio, but he was traveling in the opposite direction of the Air Force Base. The Tracer would drive onto the Interstate Center median and traveled several hundred yards, negotiating between two light poles before it struck an object. This caused the vehicle to briefly go airborne, but after it came back down on all four wheels, it returned to the interstate and continued traveling westbound. The two motorists behind the Tracer said it drove between 60 to 65 miles per hour for the next few minutes, but after it passed the exit for Johns Road, it veered off the right shoulder, crossing the side median in the access road for about 43 feet, before it clipped a tree and spun sharply in a clockwise direction until it crashed into a second tree with great force. When emergency workers arrived at the scene, they discovered Colonel Shue's body in the driver's seat, as the impact of the crash had caused the driver's side to cave in, and he was killed instantly after suffering fatal head trauma. However, it soon became apparent that this was not a normal accident, as Shue had duct tape wrapped around each of his wrists, as well as the top of each of his boots. The loose end of each piece of tape was dangling around 4 to 5 inches from his wrists, and since no roll of duct tape could be found at the scene, it almost appeared that Shue had been bound at some point before he managed to break free. The colonel also had a number of strange injuries on his body, which had clearly not been caused by the crash. The t-shirt beneath his Air Force uniform was ripped open from the chest to the navel, and he had a 6-inch vertical gash in his chest. The distal joint from the pinky finger on Shu's left hand had been removed, and most disturbingly, both of Shu's nipples were cut off. The missing digit and the nipples could not be found inside the vehicle or anywhere near the accident scene. Even though Shu was carrying $47 in his pants pocket, his wallet and military dog tags could not be found either and were never recovered. Since no one could place the colonel at the Wilford Hall Medical Center that morning, it seemed apparent that he never arrived at work, and something very odd happened to him during the 2.5-hour window after he left his home. For some reason, Tracy Shu did not learn about her husband's fatal crash for several hours when the Kendall County Sheriff's Office showed up at her residence to inform her about what happened at around 3 p.m. According to Tracy, even though they did mention that duct tape had been wrapped around Phil's wrists and ankles, she was not told about the strange injuries and mutilation to her husband's body until a San Antonio newspaper reporter phoned her up and asked for comment about it about a month and a half later. On the surface, it almost appeared that at some point during his commute to work, Phil had been abducted and tortured at an unknown location, but managed to escape. He made it back to his own car and attempted to flee, but lost control of the vehicle and was killed before he managed to get help. But believe it or not, after a lengthy investigation which involved several agencies, including the local and state police and the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, they all reached the conclusion that Colonel Shu had suffered some sort of psychological breakdown and his death was an elaborate suicide. Shu's autopsy was performed at the office of Dr. Vincent DeMaio, the chief medical examiner of Bexar County, Texas, who was also considered to be one of the top forensic pathologists in the country, and he concurred with the suicide ruling. According to the two motorists who had followed behind Shu's Mercury Tracer on Interstate 10, the brake lights never went on when the vehicle veered off the road, and since no skid marks could be found at the scene, it appeared that Shu made no attempt to stop himself from crashing into the trees. There were no defensive wounds found on Shu's body to indicate that any struggle had taken place, and the autopsy uncovered scratch abrasions near the gash in his chest, which appeared to be consistent with hesitation marks, almost as if he had been working up the will to self-inflict those wounds. Shu also had 2.4 milligrams per liter of an anesthetic called lidocaine in his system, and it wouldn't have made much sense for a third party to inject him with a painkiller if they were planning to torture him. This made Dr. DeMaio suspect that Shu injected the lidocaine into himself in order to dull the pain while he slashed his own chest and cut off his own nipples and fingertip. DeMaio did not buy the theory that Shu was in the midst of attempting to escape from his captors because he did not make any apparent attempt to seek help. Right before he crashed his car, Shu drove past several businesses, as well as three exits which would have taken him back to his hometown of Burney. In addition, he passed by a patrol car from the Burney Police Department which had pulled over by the side of the interstate to assist a motorist and was easily visible because of its flashing lights. Shu's cell phone was also found inside his vehicle, but records would show that no calls were made from the phone that morning. 2 years after Colonel Shu was killed, the Lackland Detachment of the Air Force Office of Special Investigations produced a 20-page document called a psychological autopsy, which also concluded that his death was a suicide. The report represented the position of two board-certified forensic psychiatrists from the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, Lieutenant Commander Gerald Donovan and Colonel Elspeth Cameron Ritchie, who believed that Shu's mental state had made him depressed, anxious, and paranoid in the months before he was killed. Shu had been receiving treatment from Lieutenant Colonel Douglas Dion, a staff psychiatrist at the Brooke Army Medical Center, and 6 months before he died, Shu reportedly told Dion that he'd experienced a dark and disturbing, quote-unquote, dissociative episode in which he imagined his car going out of control on his way to work while great violence was done to him. If true, this seemed to support the idea that Shu had staged the fatal car crash of his own accord. Well, needless to say, Tracy Shu did not believe her husband would have taken his own life, as she and Phil had made plans for the future, and he actually put a deposit down on the house they purchased in Alabama the day before he died. Tracy's original plan was to have Phil's body cremated and his remains interred at Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia, but the suicide ruling changed all that, and she ordered the funeral home to store her husband's body in a refrigerated crypt. She eventually hired the services of another famous forensic pathologist, Dr. Cyril Wecht, who performed his own autopsy. He expressed his disagreement with Dr. DeMaio's original conclusion, as he believed that another person was likely involved in Chu's death. Even though DeMaio believed that Chu had injected himself with lidocaine in order to dull the pain while inflicting wounds on himself, Wecht could not find any injection marks on Phil's body and did not believe there was enough lidocaine in his system to have caused much pain relief. Tracy confirmed that on the night before he was killed, Chu was complaining about itchiness since he had shaved his chest in order to take a cardiac stress test. Since Chu had recently self-prescribed EMLA cream to himself, Dr. Wecht's theory was that he may have applied it to his chest in order to combat the itchiness, as EMLA cream has lidocaine as one of its ingredients, and a small amount of it could have slipped into Chu's bloodstream after his chest was sliced open. However, the counter-argument to this theory is that the cream also contained an anesthetic called prilocaine, but no trace of it was detected in Chu's system. Another troubling discrepancy Wecht found was that no fingerprints belonging to Chu or a third party could be found on the duct tape on his wrists and boots, which seemed to go against the idea that Chu applied the tape himself. Even if Chu used gloves to avoid leaving fingerprints, none could be found at the scene, and while a latex glove was visible in the original crime scene photos, it looked like it had never been used or worn. So if Colonel Chu was responsible for inflicting the injuries on himself and staging his own suicide, he would have needed to leave a cutting instrument, both of his nipples, the distal joint from his left pinky finger, his wallet, his dog tags, and possibly some gloves at another location where they were never found, before driving several miles and intentionally crashing his car. One of Dr. DeMaio's biggest arguments for Phil having staged the scene is that he never attempted to use his cell phone to call for help, but according to Tracy, one of their neighbors retrieved the phone from the accident scene after receiving permission to take it from the authorities. The cell was a clamshell-style flip phone model, and the neighbor said that when they opened it, they noticed a large amount of blood on the inside, though there was little blood on the outside. However, since the phone was never taken into evidence and examined, this detail about the blood could not be corroborated. The psychiatrist Phil had been seeing, Lieutenant Colonel Douglas Dion, also believed that he was responding well to treatment and did not appear to be suicidal. There's also been some dispute about the story that Phil supposedly shared with them 6 months prior to his death, where he described a dissociative episode about his car careening out of control while traveling to work. Even though this information was included in Phil's psychological autopsy report, Dion supposedly maintained that he never shared this story with anyone from the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and there was no documentation about it in any of Dion's notes. Tracy managed to exert enough pressure on Kendall County District Attorney Bruce Curry that he agreed to convene an investigative grand jury to examine her husband's case, but they ultimately concluded that there was no evidence of homicide and the initial suicide ruling was correct. When Tracy testified at the grand jury proceedings, she mentioned that she had not cremated Phil as originally planned and instead brought in Dr. Wecht to perform a second autopsy. This revelation caused Curry to become enraged and confront Tracy in a stairwell, where he stated, quote, "Since you like to testify so much, perhaps I should accuse you of the crime and have you end up in the defendant's seat," end quote. Right from the outset, Tracy believed that the person who seemed like the most likely suspect to be responsible for killing her husband was his estranged ex-wife, Nancy Chu Timpson. By this point, Nancy had gotten remarried to Lieutenant Colonel Donald Timpson, who was an active duty pilot in the Air Force Special Forces Unit, and they were both living in Florida. While Phil was with Nancy, she became the beneficiary on a pair of life insurance policies totaling $1 million, and as part of their divorce settlement, Nancy retained the right to hold on to these policies, even though they were no longer married. Over the years, Phil frequently asked Nancy to cancel the policies, but she refused, claiming she could not afford to. The suspicion about Nancy began in May of 1999, nearly 4 years before Phil's death, when he received an anonymous typewritten letter which read, quote, "Please read this letter. You may be in danger. I'm writing because I remember you as such a kind and caring doctor, and I can't just sit by and not help you by telling you what I know," end quote. The writer then went on to say that a friend of theirs worked with Nancy's husband, Donald, and had heard them say they wished Phil was dead so they could collect his life insurance. The friend apparently thought that the couple might have been planning something, so the writer said they felt the need to type up a letter and send it to Phil in order to warn him. It's been reported that Phil received a second cryptic anonymous letter at a later time, which read, quote, "The plan is now delayed, but not canceled. Be careful. I can't identify myself, because they may find out and stop letting information slip," end quote. Phil's response to these letters was to write to Nancy and confront her, and he once again demanded that she drop the life insurance policy she had on him, stating, quote, "I feel helpless to prevent my eventual murder if you hire good assassins." Nancy wrote Phil back and denied that her conversation with Donald about wishing him dead ever took place, and she expressed her belief that someone was playing a sick joke on him. She still refused to cancel the policies, and when Phil tried to contact the two insurance companies holding the policies, USAA and Northwestern Mutual, and asked them to cancel the policies on his behalf, they refused. The companies told Phil that they were not authorized to do this since Nancy owned the policies and kept paying the premiums. He responded by sending them a letter which read, quote, "Thoroughly examine my death for evidence of foul play, even if on the surface the cause would appear natural or accidental," end quote. According to Tracy, Phil's paranoia over Nancy potentially harming him is what caused him to start showing symptoms of depression and anxiety and seek psychiatric treatment. While Tracy thought the anonymous letter was a piece of evidence which supported the idea that her husband was the victim of foul play, investigators suspected that Phil had actually typed up the letter himself and fabricated the entire threat from his ex-wife. They found it odd that Phil never made any attempt to bring the letter to the police, but Tracy maintained that because Phil held a top-secret security clearance, he had to follow a specific chain of command and notify his own superiors about what was happening before he involved any outside agencies. Tracy claimed that Phil did show the letter to his superiors, but they seemed to dismiss the idea that it represented a real threat against him. No conclusive evidence was ever found to prove that Phil was the author of the letter, and unfortunately, it was never tested for DNA or fingerprints. When questioned, Nancy claimed that both she and Donald had alibis, which proved they were at work in Florida on the date Phil was killed. Nancy also turned down the police's request to take a polygraph, and since Donald held a top-secret security clearance, he would not have been allowed to take a police polygraph, even if he was asked. At one point, Nancy's lawyer made a statement that he believed Phil's death was a result of him attempting to fake an abduction in order to make it look like his ex-wife had harmed him. Well, 2 months after the accident, Tracy filed a civil lawsuit in hopes of preventing Nancy from collecting on Phil's $1 million life insurance policies. Nancy was named as a defendant, in addition to the two insurance companies, USAA and Northwestern Mutual, as Tracy believed they had a legal obligation to cancel the policies after being informed about the threat on Phil's life. Phil and Nancy's son, Jeffrey Hsu, was named as a third-party defendant in the lawsuit, as Phil had removed Jeffrey as the secondary beneficiary from his will only 5 days before his death and replaced him with Tracy's sister. According to Tracy, Phil was concerned about Jeffrey's ability to manage money, as he had gone through a bankruptcy the previous year, which was partially brought on by gambling debts. Jeffrey was also in the midst of his second marriage, which Phil did not believe had much stability, so he feared that any inheritance his son received from him could be squandered in a divorce settlement. When Nancy was given a videotaped deposition as part of the lawsuit and asked about her ex-husband's death, she pleaded the Fifth Amendment on over 20 questions in order to avoid self-incrimination. It was never established if Jeffrey found out he had been removed from his father's will prior to his death, as he filed an affidavit invoking his Fifth Amendment privilege and declined to speak with law enforcement and military investigators. In June of 2008, Tracy's civil lawsuit was ready to go to trial in Kendall County Court of Law, but by this point, Nancy, Jeffrey, and Northwestern Mutual had been dropped as defendants, as a $1 million settlement agreement had been made between them. USAA was the only remaining defendant, and they were still facing potential liability issues for refusing to cancel their life insurance policy on Phil. Halfway through the trial, Judge Bill Palmer suddenly dismissed the jury after announcing that the two parties had reached an agreement that he could make a ruling on the case on his own. In the end, Judge Palmer ruled that USAA had done nothing wrong by refusing to cancel Colonel Hsu's insurance policy and were not liable for damages, but he also surprised everyone by stating, quote, The evidence considered by the court substantiates a finding that Colonel Philip Shue was murdered. The court therefore finds that the April 16, 2003 death of Colonel Philip Shue was a homicide. End quote. While Judge Palmer requested that Shue's death certificate officially be changed from suicide to homicide, Kendall County officials refused to do so, as they did not believe that Palmer had the authority to make that determination. Months later, the Texas Attorney General ruled that Shue's death certificate would not have to be changed, so his cause of death is still officially listed as a suicide to this day. In March of 2009, the story would receive national exposure when 48 Hours aired an episode titled The Curious Case of Colonel Shue, and shortly thereafter, Tracy was contacted by someone who had watched the show and thought they might have an important piece of new information. On the morning Colonel Shue was killed, the witness said they had been driving on a rural road leading to Interstate 10, which Phil normally would have taken on his route to work. They remembered seeing Phil's Mercury tracer off the side of the road, and a blue van with tinted windows was parked directly behind it. What was particularly interesting about this location is that the ground had a natural deposit of caliche, a sedimentary rock which produces a white clay substance. According to the autopsy report, the bottoms of Phil's boots were caked with mud and a white powdery substance at the time he was found, but investigators never bothered to analyze it. The 48 Hours episode contained interviews with Lieutenant Roger Anderson of the Kendall County Sheriff's Office, who had been the top-ranking official at the crash scene that morning and became an advocate for Tracy Shue. He openly acknowledged that the investigation was mishandled and that he lost control of the scene, as there was a jurisdictional beef between all the different law enforcement agencies who showed up there, including the Kendall County Sheriff's Office, the Bourne Police Department, and the Texas State Police. Since Colonel Shue's death was not believed to be a homicide, his vehicle was never processed as a potential murder scene, and important evidence may have been lost or never collected. Tracy has claimed that even though Kendall County authorities have asked her to pick up her husband's wrecked car from the impound yard on several occasions, she has always refused to do so because she believes the vehicle is a crime scene. After Tracy changed her mind about having him cremated, Phil was finally buried at Arlington National Cemetery with full military honors. But in a tragic postscript to this story, his son Jeffrey would unexpectedly pass away in October of 2015 following a brief illness at the age of 45. While Colonel Philip Shue's death has never officially been reclassified as a homicide, his loved ones are still searching for answers, and the actual circumstances of what happened to him remain unclear. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, I would like to take a moment to reminisce about this one time I was hanging out with friends, and during the middle of a conversation, they noticed that I had suddenly disappeared. For a couple minutes, it was a bit of a mystery where I was, but my friends didn't have to say the trail went cold. In fact, when they found me, their first response was, I guess you could say, the trail went fiendish. Yep, that's right, there I was sneaking off to play Best Fiends again and losing track of time. But it's easy to understand how something like that could happen. Best Fiends is a free-to-download mobile puzzle game which contains thousands of exciting levels and new adventures and challenges every time you play. And what's even better is that brand new events and challenges pop up all the time to keep everything fresh, and you'll have the opportunity to earn exclusive in-game items, characters, and rewards. There are dozens of unique fiends to collect, and you can power up your favorites to new levels so that they'll receive powerful skills and you can watch them transform as they get stronger. I've been playing Best Fiends for over 2.5 years now, and it's a great way to de-stress while researching, writing, and recording these podcast episodes. In fact, I recently just passed the milestone of level 4,000, but like I just mentioned, new levels are added all the time to keep things fresh, so I could keep playing this game indefinitely if I wanted to. Best Fiends has definitely become one of my favorite extracurricular hobbies, and I hope you wind up enjoying it as much as I have. So download Best Fiends for free from the App Store or Google Play. Plus, earn even more with $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. So like I mentioned in the intro, I've covered a lot of cases on this podcast in which a victim's death was ruled to be a suicide, but their loved ones were adamant that foul play had taken place. However, the circumstances of this one are a bit more complex. Regardless of what actually happened to Colonel Philip Shue, the one indisputable fact about this case is that his exact cause of death was a car crash. While the authorities believe that Shue inflicted a bunch of wounds on himself before intentionally crashing his vehicle as part of an elaborate suicide, his loved ones believe that he was in the midst of being tortured by a third party and managed to escape and flee the scene, but wound up getting into a fatal accident before he could get help. Even if conclusive evidence was found to prove that someone held Colonel Shue captive and tortured him that morning, could they technically be charged with murder? I mean, I'm sure they would be charged with something, but Shue's death technically took place while he was behind the wheel of his own car, and while he was obviously at a diminished capacity because of his ordeal, I'm sure this would be a pretty complicated legal situation if a suspect was ever brought to trial. But while Tracy Shue and everyone who cared about Phil want justice for his death, I'm sure one of their most important priorities is to clear his name and debunk the official cover story that he killed himself. This was a particularly horrible tragedy for Phil's parents, Bruce and Miriam Shue, who both lived until their late 90s and had to endure the loss of all four of their sons before they passed away. In addition to losing Phil, they lost an infant son named Stephen back in 1946, their oldest son Norman when he passed away in 1999 at the age of 64, and their last surviving son Roger when he died of a sudden illness in 2010 at the age of 59. And if that wasn't enough, Phil's son Jeffrey would also unexpectedly pass away due to illness at age 45. In virtually every case like this, the victim's loved ones will insist that they were not suicidal and had everything to live for, but like I've mentioned countless times on this podcast, sometimes people will suddenly take their own lives without any warning whatsoever and completely surprise everyone. I know that Phil and Tracy had made a number of plans for the future, and he was only about 6 months away from retiring from the military and starting a new chapter of his life, but since he had spent the past few years seeking treatment for depression and anxiety, I think it's a stretch to say that suicide was an absolutely impossible option. Now, there are documented cases in which victims have killed themselves and gone to great lengths to ensure their deaths do not look like suicide, though slicing open your chest and cutting off both your nipples and a joint from your pinky finger before deliberately crashing your car does seem like a pretty horrific way to end your own life. The reason that vehicular suicides are so risky is that you could end up paralyzed, which would be a fate worse than death for a suicidal person. One of the big issues with how Colonel Shue died is that he didn't crash head-on into a tree, but instead drove off the road and clipped one tree before he spun into a second tree with such force that he was killed by the impact. I don't think anyone could predict with absolute certainty that a crash like that would end their life, but then again, if Shue was in a very dark place and suffered a complete psychological breakdown, he may not have been in the most rational state of mind that morning. All that being said, even though there are a number of details about Shue's death which point to the involvement of an outside party, it's really hard to come up with a scenario involving abduction and torture that makes much sense. I've read the psychological autopsy report that was produced by the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and while there are definitely issues with some of their conclusions, they do make some valid points which seem to blow holes in the foul play theory. Shue left his home in his Mercury Tracer that morning in order to make the 30-mile commute to work, and theoretically, there should have been no reason for him to stop anywhere and put himself in a position to be abducted. You also have to take into account that Shue took a break from his ordinary routine by leaving an hour earlier than usual in order to catch up on paperwork at his office. So unless someone was watching his home when he left, how could they have known that Shue would be out on the road driving at that particular time? The biggest issue with figuring out what happened is that we have zero evidence of Shue's whereabouts during the 2.5-hour window between when he left his residence at 5:45 a.m. and when his car was seen driving erratically down Interstate 10 between 8 and 8:15 a.m. All we really have is an eyewitness who came forward 6 years after the fact and recalled seeing the Mercury Tracer off the side of the road with a blue van parked directly behind it. This sighting took place on a road that Shue ordinarily would have used to drive onto the interstate during his commute to work, so I could see someone intercepting and abducting him. But if so, where did they take him to be tortured? Since the duct tape on Chu's wrist was torn, this suggested that he might have been tied to a chair at some point before he broke free, but where was this location? If Chu's abductor or abductors forced him into the van against his will and traveled elsewhere, did someone else drive the tracer there? Remember, Chu was killed while driving the tracer, so if he managed to escape, he had to wind up back in his own car at some point. No matter which side of the fence you're on in regards to Chu's death, there are a lot of unexplained gaps about how he got from point A to point B. Of course, what adds to the controversy of this case is that two of the world's most famous forensic pathologists have performed or overseen autopsies on Colonel Chu and reached differing conclusions. Dr. Vincent DiMaio believes his death was a suicide, and Dr. Cyril Weck believes that he was the victim of foul play. Even though both men are very famous figures in their field, that's not to say that either of them is infallible or always reach the most logical conclusion, so your opinion on this case might depend on whether you find DiMaio or Wecht to be a more credible source. And if the differing opinions from both these men wasn't enough, there's also the finding from Kendall County Court of Law Judge Bill Palmer that Colonel Chu was the victim of a homicide. I mean, I know that Tracy Chu took this as a victory of sorts, but the issue is that Judge Palmer made this statement during a civil trial, which was based around determining whether or not an insurance company should have been held liable for not canceling the policy that Phil's ex-wife Nancy had on him. The trial had nothing to do with figuring out if Phil's death was a suicide or a homicide, but Judge Palmer took it upon himself to make that statement, and regardless of whether or not you believe he was right, it does not sound like he had the full legal authority to change the official ruling, which is why Phil's death is still listed on the record as a suicide. Well, I think the one thing that we can all agree on is that even if it was a suicide, the original investigation was botched in a huge way, and there are just way too many discrepancies which have never been adequately accounted for. Now, it's no secret that Tracy personally believes that Nancy Chu Timpson was responsible for Phil's death because she was hoping to cash in on his insurance policies. Since Nancy was a board-certified sex therapist who had studied the practice of sadomasochism, Tracy thought she might have been capable of torturing Phil and performing such gruesome acts as slicing off his nipples. When Tracy was interviewed on the 48 Hours episode by correspondent Troy Roberts, he asked if Phil ever had an interest in sadomasochism or a fetish for pain in which he would experience sexual pleasure through self-mutilation. Tracy responded by saying, quote, "No, he did not. And it's interesting that you would ask that question, because you are actually the first person out of the entire 5-year time frame that has ever asked me that question, and I do believe it is an appropriate question to ask," end quote. Indeed, I suppose an alternate theory is that Phil's death might not have been a suicide, but rather the result of an odd sadomasochistic sex game gone wrong, which led to him being killed in a failed car crash. But it does not sound like there was anything found in Phil's background to suggest he had some sort of double life or any dark secrets. I know Dr. DiMaio believed that scratch abrasions found around the gash on Phil's chest were consistent with hesitation wounds, as if he had to work up the will to cut himself, but it's worth noting that there were no signs of hesitation marks around the cuts on Phil's mutilated nipples. But if Phil really did inflict all those wounds on himself, it may have been the result of some sort of mental breakdown. Looking through Phil's psychological autopsy report, it seems like all of his issues with depression, paranoia, and anxiety began in May of 1999, after he received that anonymous typewritten letter which warned that Nancy and her husband Donald were planning to have him killed to cash in on his life insurance. If the letter was legitimate, and Nancy and Donald were responsible for Phil's death, you might be wondering why it took them 4 years to actually go through with it. But let's not forget that after Phil received the letter, he contacted Nancy in order to confront her about it, so she may have felt that killing him a short time later would arouse too much suspicion and decided to hold off on her plan. I still find it a bit surprising that Nancy was allowed to retain these life insurance policies as part of the divorce settlement, because, well, it must be a bit unsettling to know that an ex-spouse, whom you're no longer on good terms with, stands to gain $1 million from your death. Now, those who believe that Phil's death was a suicide hold the position that he fabricated the anonymous letter himself, and I have to acknowledge that there are definitely some things about it which seem really off. The writer starts off by saying, quote, "I'm writing because I remember you as such a kind and caring doctor." So this would imply that they personally knew or crossed paths with Phil in the past. But here is the exact wording of the next line, quote, "A friend of mine who worked with Don, your ex-wife's husband, told me some scary things. I don't know Don or your ex-wife myself. Sorry, I don't even know her name," end quote. Okay, we don't know exactly where the writer was from, but I'm assuming it would be Florida, since that's where Nancy and Donald were living at the time. Colonel Shue was stationed at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida years earlier, so it's not implausible that the writer could have originally met him there. But I find it very strange that this person seemed to know enough about Phil's background that they managed to dig up his address in Texas and also knew the first name of his ex-wife's current husband, yet they don't know his ex-wife's actual name? The writer seems to be passing along third-hand information they heard from a friend of theirs, but wouldn't this friend have been able to tell them Nancy's name? The phrase, "my friend," is used a lot in this letter, with sentences like, quote, "My friend told me they wish you were dead so they could collect life insurance. I don't understand why they would have life insurance on you, but that's what my friend told me. My friend thinks they may actually be planning something," end quote. Well, if this friend actually exists, and they overheard someone discussing a murder plot, it's surprising they never went to the authorities or came forward to corroborate the writer's story. Even if Phil did not fabricate this letter himself, I still have a feeling that the writer was fudging certain details or not telling the whole story. Whatever the case, if you read Phil's psychological autopsy report, it details a number of incidents in which he exhibited strange behavior in the year and a half following the receipt of the letter. These incidents could be the result of the threat on Phil's life having a negative impact on his mental health, or alternatively, he was already suffering from serious mental health issues beforehand, and that's what caused him to fabricate the letter. So in June of 1999, only 1 month after the letter arrived, Phil reported another strange incident in which he was working in the library at the University of Texas at San Antonio and went to use the washroom, but when he returned to his table, he discovered that his laptop had been stolen. Well, the story goes that sometime later that month, Phil's laptop was returned as he suddenly discovered it on the hood of his car, alongside a note which stated that if he reported anything to the police, others would die. Phil also claimed that the laptop of his hard drive had been wiped clean. At the time, Phil was a student at the residency in aerospace medicine and was working on his thesis for a master's degree in public health. He told the program director that his only copy of the thesis had been on the laptop and was erased when the hard drive was wiped clean. In spite of this, Phil eventually did complete his thesis and earned his master's degree, but another unusual incident took place in October of 2000 when he took the aerospace medicine board exam and scored a zero. Since the exam was all multiple choice questions, the statistical odds of Phil guessing every single answer incorrectly seemed astronomical, so it appeared that Phil had made a calculated choice to get every question wrong for unknown reasons. If that wasn't enough, in July of 2000, Phil found himself being detained by the police after an odd incident on a flight from White Plains, New York to Chicago, as he supposedly got out of his seat while the seatbelt light was on and slapped a flight attendant on the back when she asked him to sit down. Phil would later claim that he simply lost his balance because of some turbulence and brushed the flight attendant with his arm, so it was not an intentional slap. After a months-long investigation, Phil was never formally charged with any crime, but during this time period, he declined orders from the Air Force to command a squadron. He said that he wanted to legally clear his name before he accepted a command position, as he did not want to embarrass the Air Force if he wound up facing any legal trouble. All of these strange events took place while Phil was battling depression and anxiety, which seemed to be brought on by his paranoia that his ex-wife was planning to kill him. In fact, the incident from the airplane and Phil flunking the exam almost come across as if they were deliberate acts of self-sabotage for his career. There was definitely a lot of skepticism over Phil's claims that someone stole his laptop and returned it to him with a threatening note and the hard drive completely wiped clean. Even though he did report the initial theft to campus security, he never informed them about the laptop's return with the note. In fact, he never even told Tracy his laptop was stolen to begin with, though this may have been because he didn't want her to worry. Regardless of what you believe about Nancy and Donald Timpson's culpability in Phil's death, I'm not sure they would go to the trouble of traveling to Texas just to steal and erase his laptop. For all we know, the whole thing could have been an attempt at self-sabotage on Phil's part in order to fabricate a cover story for how his master's thesis was, quote-unquote, lost. The psychological autopsy report mentions these examples of strange behavior to plant the seeds that Phil was not in a sound state of mind and would have been capable of mutilating himself before staging an elaborate suicide. But it's worth reiterating that these incidents took place in 1999 and 2000, and since Phil died in 2003, I'm not sure how much bearing they have on what happened. So at the time he was killed, Phil had been taking an antidepressant he was prescribed called venlafaxine, which is sold under the brand name Effexor, but the toxicology screening turned up no traces of it in his bloodstream, which seemed to indicate that he may have stopped taking it at least 5 to 7 days prior to his death. Since Effexor does have withdrawal side effects if you abruptly stop using it, there has been speculation that going off the medication may have affected Phil's mental state and caused him to behave erratically, though getting to the point where he mutilated his own body before crashing his car would definitely be an extreme reaction. The autopsy also revealed the presence of 0.49 milligrams per liter of diphenhydramine in Phil's system, which no one has ever been able to explain. Diphenhydramine is an antihistamine used to relieve symptoms and allergies and is marketed under its brand name Benadryl, but according to Tracy, Phil did not have any allergies and she could not recall ever having seen him take Benadryl. Another strange detail on the autopsy report is the presence of white fiber material beneath Phil's underwear, which was consistent with material found in a diaper. Phil was evaluated at the urology clinic at Wilford Hall Medical Center for incontinence, and according to Tracy, since he had a recent history of prostate enlargement with frequent urination, Phil would sometimes cut up pieces of diaper to line his underwear. It's possible that the presence of the diaper material has no relevance to this case at all, but since there are just so many odd elements associated with the accident scene, I see this detail often get mentioned in online discussions about the case. Of course, the biggest point which is brought up to support the idea that Phil's wounds were self-inflicted was the presence of lidocaine in his system, as Dr. DeMaio believed that he injected himself with it in order to dull the pain. Since he worked at a medical center, Phil likely would have had access to lidocaine, but the issue is that there were no actual injection marks found on his body, which is why the theory has been presented that Phil recently applied EMLA cream to himself to combat the itchiness from shaving his chest hair. If his chest was sliced open, remnants of the lidocaine from the cream could have seeped into his bloodstream. It's been reported that a package of small gouge needles was found in the car's glove compartment, though the package was unopened and there was no record of any hypodermic syringes at the scene. But theoretically, Phil could have used a small gouge needle to inject lidocaine into his system through his chest before he cut himself and removed skin from the exact same area, completely obscuring the injection marks. DeMaio believed that if someone had been torturing Phil and wanted to inflict the maximum amount of pain, it would make no sense for the perpetrator to inject lidocaine into his body. But that might not be entirely true. In his book, From Scene to Courtroom, Examining the Mysteries, Dr. Cyril Weck devotes a chapter to this case and makes mention of a man named Enrique Kiki Camarena, an American intelligence officer for the Drug Enforcement Administration. In February of 1985, Camarena was kidnapped in Mexico by drug traffickers who proceeded to torture and interrogate him for 30 hours before he was murdered. While this was going on, Camarena was injected with lidocaine because it would stabilize his heart rate and keep him alert and awake while he was being tortured. So for all we know, maybe some sadistic kidnapper attempted to do the same thing to Phil in order to prolong his torture, but did not anticipate that he would attempt to escape and make a break for it. One of the biggest points which has been used in favor of the stage suicide theory is that when Phil was driving erratically on the interstate, he passed by all the exits which would have taken him back to his home in Burney. He also reportedly drove by a police car that was pulled over by the side of the road and never made any attempt to stop and seek help, even though he was supposedly fleeing for his life. But I think it's a bit unfair to judge the actions of a man who may have been abducted and tortured and had just made an escape from his captors, as he would have been in tremendous pain at this point and likely not in the most lucid or rational state of mind. It's worth noting that two motorists followed behind Shu down the interstate from the time he nearly crashed in the median until he fatally crashed into the trees, and for all we know, Shu could have assumed that they were his captors trying to chase him down, which is why he didn't stop. Dr. DeMaio brought up the fact that Shu's cell phone was found in his car, and he never attempted to use it to phone for help, but we also have the account from his neighbor, who claimed that traces of blood could be found on the inside of the flip phone after they retrieved it from the scene. Remember, this was still 2003, the era before wireless hands-free devices, so driving at a speed of between 60 to 65 miles per hour while trying to make a call on a flip phone would not have been the easiest thing to do, especially if you have numerous wounds on your body and are experiencing great pain. It's possible that Shu briefly opened his phone and was planning to make a call, which would explain how the blood got on the inside, but he was just too panicked and frenzied to dial a number. In addition, the area in which he was driving was known for having patchy cell phone service, so any calls he attempted might not have even gone through, and they wouldn't have shown up on cell phone records. For all we know, Shu's top priority at this point was to escape and get as far away from his captors as possible before he sought help, but then he passed out and lost consciousness, which is why his car swerved off the interstate and crashed into the trees. So like I mentioned earlier, the key to figuring out what actually happened to Colonel Shu is to account for the 2.5 hour window between when he left his residence and when he fatally crashed his car, as we just have no idea where he could have been during this time period. If Shu did this to himself, here's how all the events would have to unfold. At some point on his route to work, he pulls into a remote area where he proceeds to wrap pieces of duct tape around his wrists and boots, and he presumably has to do this while wearing gloves to avoid leaving fingerprints on the tape. He then injects himself with lidocaine before slicing a large gash in his chest, slicing off both of his nipples, and cutting off the distal joint from his left pinky finger. There's been some dispute about whether any cutting instrument Shu could have used to inflict these wounds was inside his vehicle at the accident scene. According to one police report, two small pocket knives were found, one of which apparently had blood on it matching Shu's DNA, but these knives are not shown in any of the crime scene photos. The photos did show a straight razor inside the glove compartment, as well as a Swiss Army-style knife, though the knife's blade did not appear to be sharp enough to have created the incisions on Shu's body. The straight razor seemed to have a bloody discoloration on the edge, but forensic testing would later show that it was nothing more than rust. But if Shu's wounds were self-inflicted, he would have had to drive back to Interstate 10 and continue westbound at a high rate of speed for several minutes while in tremendous pain before he crashed into some trees and was killed. We have no idea where exactly the self-mutilation took place, but Shu may have needed to leave behind his severed nipples, his severed pinky finger, the cutting instrument he used to inflict these wounds, the original roll of duct tape, and the gloves he wore to wrap the tape around himself, as well as his wallet and dog tags. I mean, given that Shu's death was not treated as a homicide investigation, I'm sure the authorities didn't perform an extensive search of the area to find these missing items and extremities, but they have never turned up in nearly 20 years. On the surface, that scenario I presented does not sound believable, but the issue is that none of the scenarios involving abduction, torture, and murder seem particularly believable either. The biggest potential suspects have always been Nancy and Donald Timpson, but if their motive for having Phil killed was to collect on his insurance policies, why would they go to the trouble of torturing him first? I mean, I guess it's possible that Nancy was just a very sadistic person who wanted to inflict the maximum amount of pain on her ex-husband, but how exactly was her plan supposed to work? Theoretically, if Nancy did abduct Phil and sliced his chest and cut off his nipples, she received a major break when Phil managed to escape and fatally crashed his own car. Technically, this meant that she was no longer directly responsible for his death, and she received another stroke of good fortune when the authorities believed that Phil staged an elaborate suicide. If Phil had not attempted an escape, and Nancy murdered him and left his mutilated body somewhere, there definitely would have been a full-fledged homicide investigation, and it would not have been as easy for Nancy to collect on the policies, since insurance companies are often reluctant to pay out to a murder victim's beneficiary unless they've been cleared as a suspect. I know that suspicion has been directed towards Nancy because she pleaded the Fifth Amendment on every single question she was asked during her deposition for Tracy's civil lawsuit, and never officially denied on the record that she was responsible for Phil's death. But that shouldn't necessarily be taken as an indicator of guilt, as she was likely doing this on the advice of her attorney. Remember, you can't just be selective about what questions you want to answer, because if you plead the fifth on one question, you have to plead the fifth on all of them. Even if Nancy had no actual involvement in her ex-husband's death, she may have feared that just answering one question might open the floodgates and force her to talk about some stuff she didn't want to discuss under oath. I think that one of the most frustrating aspects of this case is that details about the alleged alibis for Nancy and Donald are incredibly vague, as all we know is that they were supposedly at work in Florida on the day Phil was killed. I have no idea how extensively this was verified, but you think that traveling from Florida to Texas and back would leave some sort of paper trail. I guess it's possible that Nancy could have hired someone to abduct and murder Phil while she remained in Florida to establish an alibi, but again, it does seem counterproductive to hire an outside party to torture your ex-husband if your primary motive is insurance money. Of course, a third possibility, which was once brought up by Nancy's attorney, is that Phil's death was not actually a homicide or a suicide, but a failed attempt by him to stage an abduction and possibly frame his ex-wife for harming him. And while his plan involved intentionally crashing his car, he never actually intended to die. The first time eyewitnesses saw Phil's Mercury Tracer driving erratically, it was traveling in the interstate center median for several hundred yards and negotiated between two light poles before it struck an object, causing the vehicle to go airborne. This could be interpreted as Phil making an attempt to intentionally stage an accident, but it didn't go as planned, since his car wound up flying through the air instead. He then decided to travel down the interstate for a couple more miles and veer off the road and crash into some trees, but the impact wound up killing him. One potential argument against Phil's death being a suicide is that he spent years obsessively attempting to cancel the policies Nancy had on him, but the insurance companies refused to do so. And by killing himself, Phil would essentially be guaranteeing that his ex-wife got exactly what she wanted. But if Phil attempted to stage a phony abduction and mutilated himself to make it look like he was tortured, then perhaps he thought he could finally make people believe that Nancy was trying to kill him. After all, if you've been following the news lately, you're probably familiar with the story of Sherry Papini, who told everyone that she was abducted and held captive for 3 weeks back in 2016 before she managed to escape. But of course, her so-called captors were never identified, and as you probably know, it's recently been revealed that the entire kidnapping ordeal was a complete hoax. So people are capable of doing things like this, though once again, cutting off both your nipples and a tip of one of your fingers and slicing a 6-inch gash on your chest seems like a very extreme step to take in order to frame your ex-wife. It's not a very logical plan, but if Phil suffered a complete mental breakdown, then we shouldn't apply standard logic to his actions. However, the one wild card in this case is Phil and Nancy's son Jeffrey, who was removed from his father's will only 5 days before his death. I mean, Phil's logic made sense, as Jeffrey had been suffering from financial problems, and there was concern about how responsibly he would handle any inheritance he received. But it seems like one hell of a coincidence that Phil made this decision so soon before he was killed. On one hand, if Phil was planning a suicide, this may have been his way of ensuring that Tracy would get full control of his assets and they would not be squandered by his son. But on the other hand, even if Jeffrey had issues with money, I haven't heard anything about him being estranged from his father or them having a terrible relationship. Remember, even though there was a good chance that Jeffrey was conceived through an affair and was not actually Phil's biological son, he still raised him as his very own. In spite of Jeffrey's financial issues, he did manage to get a job as a pilot for Delta Airlines, and his father was proud of his accomplishments. At the very least, I'd expect that Phil will want to ensure that Jeffrey was taken care of while he was gone. I guess being removed from the will could have been a potential motive for Jeffrey to have his father killed, but it's unclear if Jeffrey found out until after Phil's death. It's also not clear to me what kind of relationship Jeffrey had with his mother at that point. Since he lived in another state, for all we know, Jeffrey had an airtight alibi clearing him of any involvement in what happened, but he never gave interviews or was formally questioned about this case under oath. Since Jeffrey passed away 6.5 years ago, we never got to hear his side of the story or his thoughts about what happened to his father. I suppose the most damning piece of evidence that the scene might have been staged is the alleged statement Phil made to a psychiatrist, Lieutenant Colonel Dion, 6 months prior to his death, where he mentioned having a dissociative episode in which he imagined his car going out of control on his way to work while great violence was done to him. The psychological autopsy report treats this as a piece of foreshadowing in which Phil practically announced what he was planning to do, but there's a lot of dispute about whether or not he actually made the statement. When the case was featured on 48 Hours, Dion declined to be interviewed on camera, but the show claimed that he shared this story about the dissociative episode with them. However, according to Cyril Weck's book, From Scene to Courtroom, Examining the Mystery, Dion has said that if he was ever asked about Shu's alleged statement under oath, he would deny that it ever took place. So this is definitely one of those cases where you're going to find conflicting information about key details from different sources, and you pretty much have to make up your own mind about which side you believe. And I have to be honest, I've always had a difficult time figuring out what actually happened here, as no theory makes 100% complete sense. If you read Colonel Shu's psychological autopsy report, it does make a fairly convincing case for his death being a suicide, and you might come away believing that he staged the entire accident. But at the same time, it fails to come up with logical explanations for some of the major discrepancies involving Shu's death, and requires you to make a lot of assumptions about his mental state. I suppose it's possible that all this drama involving his ex-wife and the insurance policies is nothing more than smoke and mirrors, and he was abducted and tortured by an outside party who has managed to stay off the radar. Maybe there was just some random psychopath who felt the urge to abduct and torture someone on that particular morning and was lying in wait for a random victim, and Colonel Shu became the unfortunate target. However, Shu wound up escaping and was killed in a car crash, but because he didn't have any known connection to the torturer, no one has ever been able to figure out who this person might be. But regardless of whether Shu's death was a homicide, suicide, or staged accident gone horribly wrong, I think the one thing we can all agree on is that he was failed in a huge way by all the agencies who were responsible for investigating his death. I mean, yes, he technically was killed by the car wreck, but if you arrive at an accident scene and discover that the victim's nipples are missing and cannot be found anywhere, then you have to assume that there's a lot more to the story. I know that Judge Palmer's ruling that Colonel Shu's death was a homicide had no official legal weight, but I still find it incredibly frustrating that all of the investigative agencies have refused to budge and take a fresh look at the case. At the very least, Shu's official cause of death should be reclassified as undetermined instead of suicide until more conclusive answers can be found. Lastly, I should acknowledge that Tracy Shu did benefit financially from her husband's death, since she received a payout of $1.8 million from both her husband's military death benefits and two other insurance policies. I'm sure there are some cynics who might take that as a sign that she was involved in what happened to him. But if that's the case, why wouldn't she have just accepted the suicide ruling and collected the money? Why spend years dragging the case through the courts and keeping her husband's story in the spotlight? So yes, I definitely think you can rule out the possibility of Tracy's involvement, as it's clear that she only wants justice and conclusive answers about what happened. I will admit that in some cases in which a victim's death was ruled to be a suicide and their loved ones disagree with the conclusion, you get the impression that there was a lot of denial at work and that pushing a homicide narrative was their coping strategy for dealing with the pain and the grief. But here, there are just so many things which don't make sense that I can completely understand why the victim's widow would continue the fight. So if you happen to have any information about the unexplained death of Colonel Philip Shu, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released another joint bonus episode with my friend Charlie from the Crime Lines podcast, in which we discussed a very famous case from Unsolved Mysteries that wound up being solved: the murder of Shannon Moore by her husband, Dave Davis. In addition, I dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another classic case from Unsolved Mysteries: the 1994 murder of Matt Flores. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are David C. and Florence L. Thank you so much for your support. I'm also pleased to announce that later this summer, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Weston Park Central Hotel in Dallas, Texas, from August the 27th to the 28th. Myself and many other prominent true crime podcasts will be in attendance, and there will be a bunch of panel sessions, discussions, and live episodes, so in order to purchase tickets, please visit the website truecrimepodcastfestival.com. That's truecrimepodcastfestival.com. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, next weekend, I'm finally going to be appearing at CrimeCon UK in London, where I'll have my own booth on Podcast Row, and I hope to meet some of you listeners there in person. And per tradition, whenever I attend a podcasting event, I like to cover a case from the host city that very same week, so next week's episode will feature a mystery from London. So until then, have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new edition of The Trail Went Cold.